This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Listen to the bite-sized business breakfast, best bits from Tuesday, April the 12th, where this morning we spoke to Brian Johnson, one of the most distinguished architects here in the region. He's the managing partner of Godwin, Austin and Johnson. Got Brian on to talk about the supply and demand issue in the real estate market at the moment. What are the solutions for developers, architects, designers and, of course, buyers as well? Is it retrofitting? Is it repurposing? Is it redeveloping? And we put all the re's to Brian. Khatija Haque from Emirates NBD was in studio live with us talking about the latest PMI data that's been released by S&P Global here in Dubai. We had a look into the baskets to see what that told us about the current state of affairs in the economy and our financial status. Ellie Scaff joined us a little earlier on. Ellie's the co-founder of Right Farm. Used to be at Careem. He's now at Right Farm, which is an agritech business looking to disrupt the supply chain model in the world of agriculture. It's the agri-landscape meeting agri-tech. Ellie Scaff is at the very forefront of that, along with the fact that he has just received 2.8 million dirhams worth of seed funding. So we spoke to Ellie about where that funding come from, their aspirations, and what's next in 2022. Plus, Samir Lakhani joined us early doors from Global Capital Partners. Samir was here to talk about specifically the Diwa IPO. Diwa going public today. So Samir joined us live on the line to talk about just how significant a day this would be, not just for the DFM, but for markets across the region and further afield. In fact, that was one that we kept an eye on throughout the course of the morning. It was one of the big talkers of the morning. Serena Kelly was with us throughout the morning as well, keeping us up to date with the big news stories.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We are counting down 35 minutes and 21 seconds until Diwa shares start trading. Tom, the excitement.
Mood in the room, mood in analysts that we've been talking to at the moment. It's going to be a good day down at DIFC today, that's for sure. Book your lunch tables now. It's just the sense of anticipation. You know, a lot of people have been talking about what parallels with Aqua Power. Saudi Aramco was the last time I think that the region was really excited about something on this scale. But there is something a little bit more localized about it this time. And it's a Dubai-born creation as well. And therefore, I think that has given more rise to the anticipation and excitement out there.
Samir Lakhani is following it closely, as are many in the financial services industry. He's managing director with Global Capital Partners here. This is what he told us.
With the excitement, with the latency of demand, with the fact that most of the investors have gotten just, you know, pennies on the dollar, I think we're likely to see a limit up at the open. Now, remember, this is any investment in the stock market is supposed to be long term. This is not for the speculative kind. But with all those caveats in play, I think we're going to see limit up today.
Limit up today. So the limit up on the Dubai financial market has got circuit breakers like many stock markets. 15% to the upside and 10% to the downside. We have had people writing in this morning that saying, actually, the circuit breakers won't be in place for Diwa when the stock launches this morning. I can neither confirm or deny that. We're looking into it, certainly, and our producers are onto that one. But it is going to be a big deal when the market's open. 37 times oversubscribed. Clearly, demand is massive for Diwa stock.
It's not for everyone. Trevor's been in touch with us this morning, says, no Diwa shares for me this morning. Just can't get my head around buying electricity from myself. Who could I complain to? Asked Trevor. Thank you very much indeed for that one. Chet's also been in touch. Morning all. Got all the allocation from my first day registration. However, only 10% of my second lot since, after all the buzz, went back in a couple of days later to finalise that. So, yeah, will be interesting. There'll be a lot of eyeballs on screens.
Well, someone I know is going to be watching is Brandy Scott messaging this morning. Where is Brandy? She's on holiday for 3 weeks or so. So you're not going to hear from Brandy for a while.
After a Diwa acquisition.
Exactly. But she put in basically, you know, half her life savings to try and buy shares, and she ended up with 1,500. That's it. At 2.5 dirhams a pop.
Yeah.
So it cost her a lot less than a plane ticket to Auckland. I know that for certain. And a lot of investors are in that position, 37 times oversubscribed. You can do the math. It's fairly straightforward. One of the parallels, and you mentioned this earlier, is Aqua Power in Saudi Arabia. And they're a power generation company. They do conventional, they do solar, much like Diwa, Paddy Padmanabhan's outfit. They IPO'd in Saudi in October at about 70 riyals a share. They're now at about 140 riyals a share.
Bosh.
So, bosh indeed. So we asked Samir Lakhani, could something similar happen with Diwa?
Is it an attractive offering? Yes, it is. Could it have been priced significantly higher? Yes, it could have. Are the margins and the underlying fundamentals improving? Yes. So when you compare it with those fundamentals, Diwa is at least on par with Aqua. Some would argue that it's even a better play than Aqua, but it's at least on par.
Bosch, as you said, Tom.
Mm. And when you've seen the success of Aqua, to hear that it's at least on par, there's an argument to be had that it could be better.
So the point is, and if you're a Business Breakfast listener, you're an investor, so you'd be thinking, do I go and buy today? Let's say it's up 20% today. Let's say it goes to 3 dirhams a share. Is there still value in that stock at 3 dirhams a share, or have you missed the boat? Or are you going to be thinking in 10 years' time, I bought Diwa at 3 dirhams a share? It seemed expensive because it IPO'd at 248 or whatever, but it's now 12 and I'm sitting pretty and it's my retirement fund. That's the question. Of course, we don't know.
No, but we can sort of look to the future, I suppose, as any amateur or expert analyst would. And then, I mean, Diwa's in a nice position in the sense that it will always be part of the infrastructure here, won't it? Regardless of where that energy comes from, be it clean energy or traditional energy or something, Diwa will be the supplier of that energy. I can't see it being broken up anytime soon here in the region. So,
it's the second most defensive stock in terms of essentials that we have to pay after Zuma,
yeah,
lunch at DIFC.
Exactly, yeah. You got your priorities right there, quite right too.
So we asked Samir not only what happens next for Diwa, but the other IPOs, because there are 10 government ones that are on the block. We know that Tecom Business Parks are on the block. We know that SALIC, for example, is on the block as well. Here's Samir.
We've got the government disinvestment or privatization program, which is a trend that you're seeing throughout the Gulf. I think Empower is another company that has already been announced by His Highness, and Diwa owns 70% of Empower. We've talked about that earlier. In terms of the private sector offerings, I think companies that have already expressed their intention to go public, Lulu is one of them. I think Americana was one of them. But you're going to see this kind of rush to capital markets over the next 12, 24 months as more and more companies seek to recapitalize as a way of expansion, not going to the traditional avenues of debt financing.
Samir Lakhani there. Serena Kelly is stuck with us in the studio this morning. Morning, SK.
Morning, guys.
Let's talk about some of the big stories that you're covering today. The RTA and Dubai Police are teaming up, and this is to do with motorcycles.
Yes, that's right. So you know how we've been talking about how UAE authorities have been launching awareness campaigns regarding road safety and motorcycles, mainly targeting the delivery riders on motorbikes. So we have just shared on the Erin News Centre Instagram quite a strong video from the RTA and Dubai Police. It's almost like a day in the life of a motorcycle delivery driver. And you can see how it highlights all parties involved. So yes, you have the responsibility of the motorcycle rider being aware of following road rules, but there is also the responsibility of everyone driving on the roads as well, be it in your car, your bus, your truck, and how you need to keep your eyes on the road. So the awareness campaign has launched their hashtag #ItCanWait, which is hoped to reduce accidents involving motorcycles. So just get onto the website, the app, or our Instagram, Erin News Centre, if you want to take a look at that video there.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, we've got a nurse here in Dubai who is in the running, not just for a local award, but an international award.
That's right. Dubai nurse among 10 finalists from around the world shortlisted for a major nursing prize. It's Jasmine Mohammed Sharaf. She is in the running for the $250,000 Aster Guardians Global Nursing Award. And it's basically, she's been nominated or put forward, so to speak, for her work during the COVID-19 pandemic, helping low-income workers in Dubai. She helped drive those who required emergency treatment to hospital. And she also teamed up with local organisations to distribute food kits as well. So now, with the 10 finalists, they're going to face a public vote. And then the winner will be declared on International Nurses Day, May 12th.
Incredible achievements. If I could nominate anyone, it would be Nurse Suleiman, the wife of our producer, Mohammed Suleiman, who a couple of years ago, at the peak of COVID, right at the start, was on the front line working as a nurse, even though she was pregnant, and still went into work every day. Just incredible work from so many people here. Very quickly, a couple of other things. Billion Meals campaign, what's the latest?
Yes, so with that, they've actually, what they've done is they have launched a, they've teamed up, you know how we, the UAE authorities recently approved the crowdfunding in the country. So we have a new initiative using just that. It's called the Giving Challenge, aimed at supporting the 1 billion meals campaign. All you need to do is check out Yalla Give and its companies, organizations, entities, and schools that'll be basically competing to be able to donate as much as possible to the 1 billion meals campaign.
Very quickly, an update. Lots of questions in about the Filipino elections. What can you tell us?
So it's just the Philippine consulate. They've come forward just reassuring Filipinos in the country that denying any allegations that have been made on social media regarding irregularities over overseas voting. So rumours had spread that basically a voter had discovered a pre-shaded ballot. In a statement, the consulate said no such incident occurred. And please just be wary about sharing advising the public against sharing or spreading unverified allegations.
Serena Kelly, thanks very much indeed.
More details on the Era News Centre app.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Food security is key here. A lot of focus on to the development of produce food here in the region. And as a result, AgTech is booming. Latest story to that end is Wright Farm, who have announced that they've raised $2.8 million in its latest seed funding round. Let's find out more about the brand. Let's find out more about the funding. And let's talk now to the CEO and co-founder of Wright Farm, Ellie Scaff, who joins us live on the line and happy to say live on Microsoft Teams. Morning, Ellie.
Hey, Tom. Good morning.
Nice
Thank
to
you
see
for having me.
Not at all. Good to hear you again and nice to see you as well this morning, albeit under a new guise in the last couple of years with Wright Farm. For those that don't know about Wright Farm, who and why did you set up Wright Farm?
Wright Farm is a B2B e-commerce and supply chain company that sources food directly from the source, be it local, regional, or global farms. And we supply and deliver to food service businesses across the UAE. And the problem statement, Tom, is simple, really. Supply chains are messy, inefficient, and you mix that in with an archaic and old industry like agriculture, and things go haywire, right? And on the other side, on the demand, food service businesses are underserved pretty much due to the low demand volume, but strict product spec requirements that they have, especially when it comes to fruits and veg.
It's obviously a problem not just you, Ellie, and your team are looking to address, but a number of investors have also got on board. Tell us a bit about the identity of your seed investors.
Absolutely. So we were fortunate to have Disrupt AD, ADQ's venture platform, on board as a lead investor. Given ADQ's play sort of on food security and their interest in agriculture and logistics, we found them to be a great partner, and they continue to support us and believe in the model that we're pushing forward.
Why is the food supply chain need disrupting at the moment?
Again, Tom, it goes back to the supply chains and how inefficient they are, coupled with the lack of tech and data involved in optimizing those supply chains. And when it comes to food, and given the pandemic and the recent regional and global conflicts, there is a big need for us to sort of secure that network, that supply chain network, and make sure at least that food is uninterrupted and people get what they need on time, reliably and consistently.
I mean, Progress has been grown here since time immemorial, tech more recently coming to the form. Agri-food landscape, but also agri-tech, is it a perfect meeting at the moment? What's the landscape look as a whole?
I mean, it is. You look at two sides, right? There's the side where you're delivering and distributing the fruits and vegetables, and then you have your vertical farming and the advent of technology in farming, right? And I think both are key for food security, because what the misconception is when we talk about food security, we only think that it's about local food production, right? Yeah. And mainly it is, but more so in a country like the UAE that imports 90% of its fresh produce, your supply chain and your importing capability and your ability to optimize and maintain that supply chain is key to food security. So I think, food security and sustainability is another one, right? With these inefficiencies in the supply chain and having too many middlemen in between the source and the end user, you end up with a lot of food wastage. And I think the UAE is pushing forward on that net zero agenda, on that sustainability agenda as well. So the landscape is looking brighter than before.
It's interesting, just looking through your career today, Ellie, and, you know, your time at PwC, your time at AstraZeneca, as I mentioned just before, time at Careem as well. You've been big on partnerships in order of moving things forward as well. Is that what the industry as a whole needs now at the moment? They need partners like Right Farm to come on and help to scale the industry and production.
Absolutely. And we're seeing a lot of positive feedback from regional players that have a similar business model that want to work together and collaborate. So this is a very fulfilling and sort of value added operation that we're doing. And we're getting calls, obviously, yesterday with the announcement as well. We've been getting calls from all sorts of players in the industry. And yeah, absolutely. That's the only way forward, right? And we work with farms here in the UAE specifically on that sort of level.
There's a global food crisis at the moment, Ellie, and there has been a lot of chat about the importance of food security moving forward. Where does Right Farm sit in that equation?
I think two main areas. One is pushing forward that local produce and local farming agenda, right? So we sell around 25% of our sales are local produce versus the national average of 10% being produced here. So that's one side of things. And then the other side is with our expansion plans in the region, we're looking to start connecting those regional farms to our demand side in the UAE and in our other markets. So I think it's a two-edged prong. One is on local farming and the other is on connecting your supply chain.
Nice start to 2022. We've got about 30 seconds left with you, Ellie, but congratulations on the seed funding round. What's next for the rest of this year?
Thank you, Tom. We're going heavy on building our tech team and tech capabilities, launching operations in multiple cities in the UAE, and soon expanding to other markets in the region.
Which I assume means we're going to be talking a lot more to you in the coming weeks and months. Ellie, good to see you. Thanks so much indeed. Lovely background as well on Microsoft Teams. Liking that this morning. Ellie Scaff is the CEO and the co-founder of Right Farm.
He is annoyingly smart and successful and nice as well, isn't he?
He's a good man, Ellie.
He's a really good guy, but he does make you feel slightly inadequate at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Let's get some more detail on one of our top stories this morning. The Dubai economy is booming. We know that because we've had data out from S&P Global. It's the Purchasing Managers Index, and for Dubai, it's the strongest that we've seen in 33 months. Joining us in the studio to give us some perspective now is the Chief Economist and Head of Research at Emirates NBD, Khatija Haque. Morning, Khatija.
Good morning.
Any surprises in this report?
No, I mean, we have seen several months of quite strong readings. There was a bit of a dip in January because of Omicron, but given that we've seen a relaxation of travel restrictions broadly since the fourth quarter of last year, we've also had Expo. We've seen a very strong rebound in tourism. So we were expecting a reasonably good reading. I think this is actually a great reading, particularly when you look at the output component of the survey, which was up, as you say, the highest in almost 3 years. But 25% of businesses in Dubai that were surveyed, and there are about 600 businesses that are surveyed, 25% of them said they had an increase in their activity in March relative to February. So, you know, that really paints a picture of an economy that is rebounding quite strongly. Obviously, last year, we still had legacy issues with Delta and various other restrictions. So the recovery last year perhaps was a little bit slower than we had hoped for. But certainly we're starting off 2022 on a very strong note.
So David Owen, who's the economist at S&P Global, said that the Dubai number moved clear of its previous post-lockdown high in March. Strongest performance in the non-oil sector in particular since pre-pandemic, June of 2019. But is this just a tail end of Expo bounce in March? Because it was, I mean, we were up there and it was absolutely rammed. That's going to tail off in April?
Well, look, the survey is seasonally adjusted. So obviously when you have low tourism season, that is something that is, it happens every year. So it's kind of built into the series. I think we probably will see some slowing. As you say, Expo was a big driver of activity over the last 6 months. But I think overall, when you look at the anecdotal news around investment in the UAE, consumers generally seem to be reasonably optimistic. And I think that, you know, that should continue to underpin solid growth over 2022. So we are looking for a faster rate of growth this year for the whole UAE relative to 2021 in the non-oil sector. We're looking for around 4.5% growth in the non-oil sector for the UAE this year. So we haven't got full year data for Dubai for 2021, but even the 9 months through September last year, Dubai's economy grew over 6%. So I think it is in a pretty strong position. We're seeing in the tourism sector, again, quite strong activity data. And also the construction sector showed quite robust survey data for this latest PMI survey. We're seeing activity in construction rise quite quickly. But what is lagging a little bit is the new work coming through for construction. So there is perhaps a little bit of uncertainty around whether, you know, the rate of projects will continue to be maintained now that Expo is over. And of course, inflation, right? So you've got input costs, particularly in those kinds of sectors where you've got to buy a lot of raw materials. Those have been increasing for businesses in the UAE as well. And that hasn't always been passed through to consumers. So when you look at the margins in construction and also in the travel and tourism sector, those seem to be under pressure. So selling prices are falling, but input costs are rising. The only sector where we are seeing some pass-through of higher input costs is in wholesale and retail trade. So we saw for the first time in several months, retailers raising prices slightly in March. So I think this is a sign both of strong demand and confidence on the part of businesses that if they do raise their prices, they're not going to end up destroying demand.
You mentioned seasonally adjusted there, and that's obviously a tricky part of this economic analysis, because we've gone from 100 miles an hour with Expo in March, not quite to, you know, 0 kilometres an hour, but going straight into the holy month of Ramadan, which is traditionally a slower time for the tourism industry here. So to strip out those big differentials is quite tricky, isn't it?
Yes, particularly because Expo was a one-off event, so it won't have occurred in previous years over that same period. So when you do seasonal adjustment, generally you look at a long time series and you look at where there are peaks and troughs over a number of years. So obviously the boost from Expo would only have occurred in late 2021 and early 2022. So it'll be quite difficult, I think, perhaps to adjust for that. So yes, it's possible that we will see some softness in the April survey coming off that very strong March reading.
Look, let's talk about commodity prices. Tom, you gave us the oil price about 5 minutes ago. It's just below $100 a barrel now for Brent, isn't it? But it's thereabouts.
There or thereabouts, yeah. It was wavering just below the end of play yesterday. It's just over. It's up a little bit this morning, just over 100.
Of course, the Gulf economies benefit from this, don't we? UAE, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. But many of our big trading partners around the region are getting hit by this, aren't they? I mean, Sri Lanka is perhaps the most obvious example at the moment, but there are issues in India, there are issues in Pakistan, big importers of energy. What impact could that have on us here in the Gulf?
Look, I think, as you say, from a fiscal perspective, the Gulf economies are going to be in a very strong position for the next couple of years, not just because prices are higher, but because they are ramping up production. And so you've got this double boost to the budget. There are two questions. One is how much does that feed through to the non-oil sector? Now, typically, you would have increased revenues matched in the past by increased spending, which would then boost domestic demand in the non-oil sectors, drive job growth, et cetera, et cetera. We don't think that that cycle will play out in quite the same way this time around. So we think governments are committed to reducing the reliance of their economies on oil revenues to drive growth. So they want to see growth coming from private sector investment rather than relying on government spending. So we think governments will largely save the bonus oil revenue that they see this year. They will probably build up their foreign exchange reserves. They will probably finance their sovereign wealth funds and use those vehicles to invest opportunistically. But really, we don't see a tremendous pass-through into the non-oil sector. The second issue, as you say, is what happens to oil importing countries in the MENA region. You've named a few, but also, Turkey is another. We've already seen inflation rates rise very, very sharply in those countries. I think what a lot of the Gulf states will probably do is offer some assistance in the form of bilateral loans, investment in those countries, to try and mitigate the impact on their current accounts of this high oil price and the deficits that they will be running. And of course, food prices are largely significantly higher and also imported. So both of those factors are going to be putting current accounts under pressure. And what you want to see is inflows in the financial accounts to kind of offset that. So that would be relatively easy for Gulf countries to offer in the form of either central bank deposits or FDI into those countries to try and support those economies in that way.
Khatija, we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there, which is a shame because I was going to ask you a question about Expo may be over, but the FIFA Football World Cup in Qatar is only 6 months away. Of course, your home country, South Africa, hosted one just a few years ago, but we'll have that conversation another time.
Perfect. Thank you very much for having me.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Those that are regular listeners to the Business Breakfast know that we talk a lot about real estate, with good reason at the moment. The real estate and the property market is booming at the moment, but there's a little bit of a problem out there, and it comes with those two words, supply and demand. There seems to be an imbalance at present. And yet, when you look around cities like Dubai and further afield here in the UAE, there are no shortage of opportunities for developers out there. But how do you address the problem? Well, you don't address the problem by Richard and I coming up with solutions, but you do address the problem by turning to one of the largest and longest established UK architectural and design firms here in the UAE. I refer, of course, to Godwin, Austin and Johnson, formerly popularly known as Gaj Around Town. And the man at the helm has been for almost 40 years now, almost 40 years of regional experience to his name. He is an influence on Model Eastern architecture is undeniable. Body of work comprises some of Dubai's most recognisable and prized buildings, among them Dubai Creek Golf Club, widely recognised as one of Dubai's first architectural icons. So much so, it features on your 20 dirham note. Just have a look at the one in your wallet now. Absolute pleasure to welcome the managing partner at Godwin, Austin and Johnson, Brian Johnson, to the show. Brian, morning to you.
Morning to you, John. How are you?
Really appreciate your time this morning. And to solve a few issues for us, that we take it as a given, Brian, that there is a supply and demand issue out there. Demand being for now, or rather yesterday, not for 2 years. So given your experience, what can developers do to meet this demand at the moment?
Well, I think one of the problems is that when there's a supply and demand issue in other parts of the world, sometimes it's you need more in the residential market, or you need it more in the office market, or different sorts of market. And obviously you can then convert from one to the other. At the moment, I think the supply problem is actually in all the sectors. So that combined with the fact that it's much more difficult in this part of the world because you don't have that unused building stock. You know, we in the UK, we've converted a mental hospital into a club. You know, we've actually put a swimming pool into a church, into a chapel. We do all sorts of strange things there, which are much more difficult to do here because you don't have that sort of, core of reusable buildings that they need repurposing. So that really everything has to be a bit new. And that, I think, combined with the fact that you've got regulations which are you know, quite prescriptive and in the interest of safety in the market, actually make it quite difficult to repurpose buildings here. There are very few examples.
Let's talk about repurposing if we can. Richard and I have been having the discussion throughout the morning about historical buildings here in the UAE. Fully respect the fact that history here is a little shorter than maybe other parts of the world. But nonetheless, these are significant architectural buildings that exist here in Dubai and other parts of the UAE. The reason we started talking about this, a rumour doing the rounds that there is a very well-known building down in the Karama area that you might have gone to post a letter or otherwise back in the day that might be up for development. Are we getting to get to a point, Brian, where you can repurpose historical buildings here, or is it all about the real estate?
I think nobody would be more delighted than me if we were able to do some repurposing. I mean, I think the nearest we've got to it as built would be the Chedi Al Bayt in Sharjah, where three old houses were converted into the parts of the hotel, and then we added obviously a lot more rooms. But you know, that is a sort of change of use repurposing. We do quite a lot of repurposing within schools. I mean, Dubai College, which I designed over 40 years ago, we're continuing to move things around, add new buildings and so on and so on. And each time it's a sort of repurposing, but within the educational environment. I think that the complete reuse of something different, and the building you're talking about, will be an exciting opportunity for something, you know, if somebody can actually get their teeth into it and do something a bit unusual. You know, there's not much point in simply changing its use and letting it stay the same. We want to see some exciting architectural interventions, you know, like you get in Barcelona with that old armory museum down there and so on.
Is there any reason why we can't do that here, Brian?
No, I don't think there is a reason why you can't. I think the opportunities, as I say, for taking a building that's you know, lost its original purpose. The only one I could think of, and we were involved with it some years ago, was the old, you know, that fish processing plant in Kalba?
Yeah.
Well, we worked with Her Highness Sheikh Ahur in Sharjah to make that into an art gallery quite a few years ago. The project died, but I think it's back on the cards again. I've heard some rumors that it's back on the cards. So that would be, you know, an industrial building turned into an art gallery. That's the sort of exciting opportunities that one might find. And that building was also, you know, quite a significant structure. It wasn't just a tin shed. You know, I think taking a tin shed and turning, you know, turning what was inside it into something else is not that exciting. But yeah, we need to see that. But there is a parallel, actually, strangely, with new buildings and repurposing. And, you know, many buildings are actually designed from the inside out, which is, if you like, form follows function, hospitals, schools, and so on. You need the functionality to be right. But other buildings, like, let's say, the Crete Golf Club, clearly the form came before working out where all the rooms would go. And in those cases, you get that similar excitement and peculiarities that you get in repurposed buildings, where you get unusual spaces and unusual opportunities, changes of level, et cetera, that if you're designing it from the inside out, you would not get. So I think we as architects in this part of the world have had to make use of those other sorts of, almost giving ourselves a constraint. And whether the constraint is a sort of symbolic one, like, again, going back to Dubai College, the idea of a English public school in the desert sort of idea, but setting those parameters and then working within them is quite an interesting way to get some of the excitement that you get from repurposing buildings.
On the other side of the 20 dirham note is the argument of retrofitting existing building or distressed projects that haven't been finished. A lot of people texting in this morning, Brian, about why don't we just take some of the buildings that haven't been finished and turn them into luxury high-end properties. Is that practical?
Yes, I think so. People have been looking at that on and off. I mean, clearly you see buildings that are half finished. We were asked to bid on one up in the Abu Dhabi Road out near Jebel Ali at one point. But there it was really just to take it and finish it, which is, I don't see that as being repurposing. I think if you end up with the same sort of building, if it was a residential building and you upgrade it, or even hotels, I mean, hotels are constantly upgrading themselves. You know, the life cycle of a hotel interior can be 5 or 7 years. You know, the outside stays much the same, and they repurpose things internally, but it's not the same. And certainly when you try to buy, for instance, a half-finished building, the people who owned it originally often ask too much money. If it's going to be taken over and finished, then it needs to be like a Harrods sale. It needs to be an absolute knockdown price to make it worthwhile for somebody to take what is, after all, a hell of a risk, because you've probably got no contractor who's going to take liability for the structure, et cetera, et cetera. So the whole, it's a very complex market when it comes to that.
Finally, just in terms of trends, a lot of people talking about the impact the pandemic has had on the trends. Are you seeing any specific trends developing in the market at the moment, Brian?
I mean, the main trend has probably been in the domestic market. I think people are looking more and more to living in properties that have got gardens and you know, bigger villas rather than flats, internal space for a private office, etc., for home working. It doesn't affect all professions, but it's certainly there's a growing market. And I think quite a few people are coming here from overseas to do just that. I think on the technology side, you've got, you know, very few people these days expect to have to flush a toilet by anything more than waving their arm at it. You know, there's increased use in copper, for instance, because copper is a natural antibiotic, you know, and so on. So I think in all areas of life, and in certainly in schools, you know, bigger spaces, wider corridors, the use of corridors as actual teaching spaces, avoiding the problems of people meeting again. I mean, hopefully we won't get another epidemic like this in our lifetimes, but, you know, clearly it will happen. And the schools that have been best able to cope are those that have actually had more flexibility of space, the ability to spread things out and so on. And I think that's going to affect modern design. I mean, certainly the schools we're working on at the moment, it's very much in the owners' minds to have that increased flexibility.
Brian, out of time on this occasion. Much appreciate your thoughts this morning. Brian Johnson is the managing partner at Godwin, Austin and Johnson. Join us live here on the show.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.